You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. This is episode number one with the topic, The Unexamined Life is Not Worth Living. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. I'm currently situated in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Seth Paskin. I'm currently in Austin, Texas.
And this is Wes Allwyn from Boston, Massachusetts.
All right, let's do the ground rules. Just a quick... to be revised for future episodes, contingent upon our whims. This is a philosophy discussion, and the first rule is we do not assume that our audience knows anything about any of this. So we're going to post links to the readings that we talk about, but we're not going to assume that you have read them before you listen. We're not going to assume that you have any background in philosophy whatsoever. The second rule is that there will be no, hopefully, no gratuitous name-dropping. So if one of us has a point to make, we should just make that point instead of saying, well, you'll understand if you go read, for instance, E.F. Stuckey's essay, The Hyperbaric Chamber and Modern Stoicism. The third and last rule, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except in cases where not doing so seems like it would be more entertaining.
Huzzah.
Yes?
I said huzzah, as in cheers.
So the reading for today that we all supposedly looked at that contains the phrase, the unexamined life is not worth living, is, of course, The Apology by Plato, supposedly a quote of Socrates. Does one of you folks want to start us off by giving a little rundown of what the thing's about?
I vote Wes does that.
Okay, so this is Socrates' speech to his jury, which is basically about 500 people. I think it's 399 BC when this happens. Is that right? So he's been accused of corrupting the youth and of making the lesser argument seem better and the better argument seem worse, and of disbelief in the gods and belief in a new spirituality, which is, to use the exact thing he's accused of, which is an odd accusation, which he makes something out of in his speech. So there's actually a series of speeches. One is his sort of defense and, I guess, interrogation of some of his accusers. And then there's the speech after sentencing, or is it two speeches?
Well, there's little breaks.
Three, right, yeah.
Before they make the decision, and after they vote against him.
Right, okay.
And then they're still going to vote on the sentence.
Right.
And then they vote to kill him.
Right.
And so he talks a little more about that and how excited he is about that prospect.
Right. So, yeah. So in the first speech, which is the longest, he responds to those charges. Second speech, I think, is where he's going to, you know, he can propose an alternative sentence, and he basically says he would rather be sentenced to death than exiled because his engagement with, you know, and this is where we get the unexamined life is not worth living phrase. So the idea is that he would rather die than stop hanging around in public squares and irritating people, going up to Athenian generals and destroying their arguments and so on and so forth.
Yes, so basically for those few individuals that have never read any Socrates, that all the rest of the Platonic dialogues about Socrates are all Socrates going and asking rubes questions to prove his various points, sort of trapping them into contradicting themselves, and so showing that they're all full of crap.
Right.
And people eventually got fed up with this.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, that's kind of a good point to bring up. So Wes kind of described sort of the outline of the text, but the context around it is that, you know, he's in his 70s and he's been harassing Athenians for a long time. And he basically does exactly what you say, which is he goes around and he says, well, what do you think you know? And they tell him, and he goes, oh, well, you know, the truth is you don't actually know what you think you know, right? And they're like, grumble, grumble. Well, I guess you're right. And eventually he's brought up on these trumped up charges, and this is really kind of a political show trial to just pro forma accuse him of whatever he needs to be accused of so that he can be put to death by the guys who don't like him. But he is already in his 70s, and this is in some sense a day late and a dollar short on the part of these other folks. So there must be some other motivations that were going on. But anyway.
Now, do we historically actually know his birth date and know that he was in his 70s, or he just says he's old and this is just some traditional?
Yeah, pretty well verified. He's 70 years old, actually, at this trial. So, and that's
the average lifespan is like 22, what is it? Not that
it's
that's
not 22
so
in Athenian
vital,
Greece, but he, you know, and Socrates himself mentions this, that it's, he wouldn't have much longer left to live. So,
and yet he has two young kids he brings up somewhere in there. Two kids that are, three yeah. kids, one of whom is an adult now, and two that are still children. So,
right.
So he's getting some right up to a
kid. He started late. Wasn't his sexual prowess supposed to be one of legend? I mean, he was supposed to be extremely well endowed and have a lot of stamina. Yeah. I think that was part of the legend as well.
I don't know why he didn't use that in his defense.
It's interesting. He was well known as a soldier during the Peloponnesian War, and he was known for his stamina. He could drink a lot without getting drunk. He could march for days without getting tired. That's part of the legend as well. But in another part of this context, so I think he was sort of celebrated even coming in his youth, coming back from the war. But then imagine someone who becomes sort of a bum. He's known to neglect his affairs. His wife is always complaining. I think there's a scene in the subsequent dialogue when he's about to die where she's berating him or something. So he doesn't make any money, he doesn't provide for his children, and he's going around, he's walking up to, like, the most powerful people in Athenian society, and, you know, more than even just arguing with them, sort of demolishing their ego in front of a sort of little set of groupies, which is the whole corrupting the youth charge, because there is a sort of pack of young people who are admire him and imitating him. And in fact, Plato, I think, is one of them. And there are some others mentioned at the trial. And the other context here is that he's often thought of as a sophist who, of course, he's highly critical of the sophists in most of his dialogues. And that there's a very anti-sophist climate at the time.
So maybe since we're assuming that nobody who's people that are listening to this don't know,
yeah.
maybe we should
go
explain
ahead and
what a sophist is.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to do that?
Well, a sophist, I guess, at one point had a kind of academic meaning. It's a teacher of rhetoric. Is that right? And then,
yeah.
But basically it came to take on a negative meaning, as did rhetoric in general in that same context, because it was thought that rhetoricians would just use language and tricks of wordplay and reasoning to confuse people and confound them. So that's essentially what he's accused of, is being a rhetorician and not whatever the alternative to that would be, a speaker of truth or a truth thinker or an approver educator, perhaps, would be the alternative.
Right. Yeah, I always think of them as like self-help gurus of the ancient world, because they went around selling their services, and they were the interest in sending your kid to a sophist day to study was to make him someone who's going to be successful in politics, for instance, or otherwise successful, someone who is going to become wealthy, or so on and so forth. So, which was an idea that was offensive to Socrates, of course, but, you know, very painfully for him, I think he was thought of as one of them, as one of those hucksters going around selling a sort of spiritual snake oil. So,
I think another bit of context that's worth mentioning is that he claims to be doing this all at the direction of the god.
Mm.
And I know there was always a lot of controversy and debate about what deity that was intended there, but he's really referring, I think, to the oracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I noticed when I was reading through it again is that, you know, he says that he was never told what to do. He was kind of told more what not to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So just in kind of getting into the text, I just rereading it, I was struck by one kind of, in my old man guise now, as opposed to my youthful philosophy student guise, I thought, man, this guy's really obnoxious. Right.
I mean,
I think I thought he was like a champion back in the day. And I was reading this and I was like,
yeah.
God, what an obnoxious guy. And the other thing is just that there's so much about gods and deities and sort of almost heresy and yet sort of divinely motivated action in here that just kind of surprised and interested me.
Well, particularly because, you know, his central claim is that, you know, we don't know anything. At least I know I don't know anything, except that I know that I'm directed by the gods to do exactly what I'm doing. And so I'm entirely confident that I should be doing this stuff instead of like, you know, supporting my family and being civil to people.
Right. And it's, you wonder to what extent he believes that sort of thing. But on the other hand, if he's going to go to his death for his principles, why not? It's hard to say what he believes because of the, you know, in other dialogues, the sort of equation of everything within mythology. I don't think he's opposed to the sort of meta or the sort of parable or the, you know, saying things which maybe are truer on some less literal sense.
You're talking about him being a sophist, and there's one argument in particular in here that I thought was particularly ridiculous. This is 25C-ish or so, but he's talking about the charge that he's been corrupting people intentionally. And I mean, unless you just buy that it's just impossible to corrupt anybody intentionally, then this argument is a little silly. Am I so hopelessly ignorant as to not even realize that by spoiling the character of one of my companions, I shall run the risk of getting some harm from him? It's either I have not a bad influence or it is unintentional. So in that case, in either case, your accusation is false. So in other words, if you corrupt someone, then you'll be part of a society in which the corrupted are with you, and there's a chance that they would hurt you. So therefore, nobody ever corrupts anybody intentionally.
Right.
So you like that?
No. So, and it's not unique to the Apology. It occurs. It's a sort of one of those Platonic themes. No man knowingly does evil. I mean, you could find a few thousand through the whole dialogues, just bad arguments by Socrates. and also, I think at some level it might be beside the point. You know, many of the dialogues themselves are unsatisfying. He's talking to people and that he's getting yes or no answers. And then the other thing, in a way, he's a notorious liar because he says things like, you know, I'm not a clever speaker and I'm just going to say things that randomly come into my head. But of course, he is a very clever speaker. So call that false modesty. But so anyway, so if you are going to bum around and talk to people, you have to bring up the quality of the kinds of arguments he's making, which I don't think it's an open and shut case.
Well, he's also an intentional martyr by the end. It's clear that he could have, by being a little nicer to the audience, you know, had them vote him not guilty or at least give him a sentence less than death. And he's charges in full throttle. I mean, he has some arguments of why, well, death is probably not so bad and we don't really know. And it's arrogant to even think that, you know, death is bad. We can talk about that in a minute. But it's just so clear. He presents himself as somebody who is with this false modesty that, I'm not doing this for personal aggrandizement. I'm not doing this. I don't pursue this kind of life because I enjoy it. I'm just doing this all for you. And when clearly he's trying to make himself a martyr, and he even says that, you know, if you kill me, then, you know, you're going to have all my students who I've been holding back until this point bugging you just as much. And I'm just going to rule the world, essentially, my philosophy, if you take me out individually. I mean, you think that's his aim there, or am I looking too far into it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's kind of a vein of threat, although I imagine the tone of the conversation being more like, well, you know, if you get rid of me, you're just gonna open the floodgates, right? You should keep me around because at least it's keeping all these other people quiet. But I think the thing that's most interesting is not whether or not the arguments are good or bad or correct. It's the point is that he thinks that doing this is the right thing to do, that he's got this divine commitment to the state and to the people or the body politic or the community, the leaders, the youth, whatever, to go around and basically put everybody through these exercises in order to either A, get to some point where you finally arrive on a truth that can't be refuted, you know, and you get to that higher level of knowledge, but because he believes the process itself is how you get to virtue, that is in itself virtuous, you know. And that's the thing that I just find kind of shocking and interesting, right, is the idea that this guy, you know, you try to imagine that today, right? Like somebody said, you know what, in order to make this a better place to live, I think what I'm going to have to do is attend all these city council meetings and just stand up. And anytime anybody talks about land development or clean water or light rail or anything like that, I'm just going to grill them until they're confused six ways to Sunday.
Do you know what light rail is, really? Why are you even alive?
Until you put into a mental institution, which is probably what would happen to them.
I don't know. Maybe society, you know, maybe things were different back at that time, and that you know, that type of activity would engender something positive. But it just I found it amusing rereading it. That's kind of the impression I got.
You fellows claim you're on a podcast. What do you even know what a podcast is? Give me a goddamn definition of a podcast, or else you can't even talk.
So now that we've reconvicted him of of his crimes. I think that, you know, there's some value to, obviously, first of all, there's this idea that he knows only that he knows nothing, which is, I think, actually something very
awesome,
foundational to philosophy. One of the things he's accused of is in delving into, you know, everything, what is it, under the earth and in the heavens. So he's being accused of being a natural philosopher, say in the spirit of, well, he mentions, I think, Anaxagoras. He says he has nothing to do with those things. So he's not interested in
somebody who
facts.
actually
in facts, let's say.
A theory of cosmology, yes.
Right. He's not interested in being a scientist and establishing facts about the external world. So in a way, it's very definitive of what it means to be a philosopher, because it's a critical activity, and the idea is that you can do all this stuff reflectively, and it's a... That's a pretty radical idea, too, because at a time when you're explaining things not just in terms of gods, but air and earth and fire, and sort of an initial attempt at explaining things in terms of natural causes.
He's doing something, this is a new activity, and it's a novel, new way of thinking, new way of approaching things, where he's looking for truth someplace different than in the gods, in natural philosophy, in poetry, in rhetoric, and so forth. And he's undertaking an activity which is extremely unusual, in a sense, kind of creating a space for this type of reflective philosophical thought that heretofore had not existed.
Right. Very good. Seth, I'm just going to have you repackage everything.
So taking us then to the central point, the data topic of the podcast, which is not actually Plato. I wanted us to talk about Socrates a little bit and have the freedom to talk about individual things that annoy us in the reading. But ultimately, those are just vaguely interesting. The philosophical meat here are these couple of key ideas, one of which was the epistemological point, that is theory of knowledge, that you guys were talking about, of maybe we don't know anything. But the other point is this, the unexamined life is not worth living. So, mm-hmm. I mean, let's maybe first deal with that in the narrow sense that he proposes it. So he thinks this specific, not just any sort of reflection on yourself and thinking about stuff, but this specific sort of self-critique and ripping down your fundamental assumptions in the way that he does is necessary. It's not just a good idea, but it's not even worth being alive unless you do that. So the hordes of people who have not heard him, doesn't it follow from that, are leading useless lives unless they've independently come up with the same thing?
So, yeah, let's read the whole, just the sentence that comes from, because I think there's a little bit more meat on that bone that'll make this a more productive discussion. So
go ahead.
I say again that daily to discourse about virtue and of those other things about which you hear me examining myself and others is the greatest good of man, and that the unexamined life is not worth living. So sort of one of the first questions is, you know, okay, the daily discourse about virtue and other things. So to undertake this activity itself is the greatest good. But I don't think it's implied in that it's the only good, nor is it implied that you do it to the exclusion of all other things like he did, right?
Well, I think it does imply that it's a necessary activity, that unless you know what the good is, you can't be doing the good consistently. You might stumble across it. So it's, you know, it's vaguely possible, but he's certainly never run into anybody that he thinks that's the case.
True. But I think what he's, you know, what I'm hearing him say is you need to undertake the activity of examining what you believe or examining what other people tell you. And you need to do that regularly. And if you don't do that, then I think actually it gets to your central point, which is people who don't do that, it's not worth them living, which I'm not 100% sure I agree with at this point.
Well, that could be one of the things Wes was talking about in terms of the exaggerations for dramatic effect.
Right. But
no, there are lots of people who really believe that. Not you know, for the unexamined, but for just the right wingers.
Well,
have you heard that rumor? Have you heard that rumor? Is it?
What rumor?
This is something my dad believes, that, and it's one of these right-wing things floating around, that Obama's having FEMA build camps for concentration camps to put conservatives into. Anyway.
To help them reflect upon their lives? And
No, that was just that was the joke part of it.
No, I hadn't heard that, nor have I seen any in the Austin area, so.
Well, they keep them pretty hidden. You know, the Germans didn't see any either, so. I'm sorry.
What day is it? What were we talking about?
Yeah, no, exactly. Okay, so let's operate on the assumption. Let's modernize this just a bit, right? In the sense that let's kind of try to abstract from the context that, and didn't the Athenians still have slaves at this time?
Sure.
Right. So there were probably people who could afford to spend all day examining their lives if they wanted to,
including Plato. Yeah.
But, you know, in today's day and age, obviously, people are preoccupied. You have a sort of much more of a, well, we have a different kind of society. Let's just put it that way. So if he just says, hey, every day, or at least every other day, right, some sort of regular basis, you should meet with like-minded people and discuss, you know, virtue, good action, politics, art, and so on. Hopefully with the goal of getting to some sort of truth, whatever that may mean. And when we finally, 16 episodes down, get to Heidegger, you and I can talk about that. But, you know, that basically if you don't take the time to do that, or if you don't do that, then you need to reexamine whether or not you're actually alive, or that your life is worth living.
See now that's interesting, because even someone like myself who was into this enough to be in grad school for way too long, when I started going out with my wife, as is the case with most new relationships, you talk about things a lot and you talk about philosophical things a lot. And I noticed the amount of philosophy involved in the talking has gone down a great deal. And it's not just because I'm not reading it as much or at all on my own. It's because when they do come up, like, well, we've kind of covered that ground before. Like, we've thought it through enough to have reached whatever conclusions we're going to reach. So unless we're talking about, you know, specifically, like, what do you think about, you know, parents who lock their kids in their car? Like, you know, unless there's a specific and practical problem for us to deal with, then there seems to be no point. Is that just me?
I don't know. I mean, there's no point if you're trying to get to a point, right?
Yeah, but that's what he's trying to say. Unless what he's saying is just you have to examine it at some point in your life, which what you were just saying is, no, this has to be a regular thing where you sort of renew yourself. And though I can certainly see the value of thinking about some stuff and thinking about the state of your life on a regular basis, but sort of exploring this, I wouldn't call it a search for virtue.
You know, maybe we should also talk about what, in that context, what would motivate us to do this podcast and have this type of conversation, right? I think you're talking about, on the one hand, the pragmatic decisions that we have to make in life. And we, you know, unlike Socrates, we've made that choice to tend to our own affairs, let's say. And, you know,
our free time on other things.
Right, exactly. tend to the internet and to the web surfing, and but
pretty much anybody that does not Twitter or Facebook every day, their life is not worth living.
Exactly.
Well, then you need to drive down here and kill me right now. LinkedIn is about as connected as I'm able to be at this point. But no, I think
that's,
so. Wes, you're
that's
making
so
a point
last
about
week.
Kind of. You're making a point about practical, sort of a practical.
Yeah,
piece
and I think also one thing that occurs to me is that interestingly enough, the youth that he's accused of corrupting haven't really gone down. You know, Plato, who I count as one of them, and a few other people are actually men of means, and they actually supported him. They were his underwriters, let's say. So part of what made his – someone has to tend to the affairs of state, at least at the political level. But again, you know, Plato, of course, was interested in all this stuff, but he never became apolitical, let's say, like Socrates. He never he didn't just give up all his money and decide to live in poverty. So that's another interesting dynamic there.
Let's just make another clarification for the completely uninitiated. The author of our reading is Plato, of course. But he you don't think this is necessary? Somebody needs this.
No, I think it's absolutely necessary.
Somebody needs this. But he's writing about his teacher, Socrates. So these are supposedly things he overheard Socrates talk about. But it's clear with Plato's later writings, which this is not one of them, even though he uses the character of Socrates, he's not giving Socrates philosophy anymore. So in Plato's scholarship, there's this whole division between the early dialogues and, you know, what Socrates actually said. And there are even other ones of his students that wrote other Socratic dialogues that are not nearly as famous versus the later Plato things, which are probably just more Plato talking about himself.
Yeah. So you have the contemplative life versus tending to all one's affairs. And then there's the question of the political version, which is pacifism versus defending oneself and one's family. The question is how far you go. And, you know, isn't it crazy for someone to say that the mere act of being contemplative is the best thing in life? You know, Conan the Barbarian would say it's, or Genghis Khan, crushing your enemies, seeing them driven before you, and so on and so forth.
Well, in the Platonic dialogue of Conan,
is that name dropping too? We can't do any popular culture.
No, absolutely, you can drop popular culture reference. And believe me, there will definitely be name dropping at that point, at some point in the future.
The more obscure popular culture reference, the better.
I guess the kind of tension that I feel in this particular dialogue, and you don't see it as much in some of the other works, right, where they're sitting around drinking and talking, and it's kind of like, oh, you know, they're kind of doing life and chatting at the same time. But this thing really sets up an opposition between, like, it draws kind of a stark line between the extreme of Socrates saying, I'm just going to wander around, neglect everything, and spend all my time thinking about how I can't come to a definitive truth about anything, and kind of the people who might like be interested in doing that for like a half an hour and then have to get back to work. Right. And right. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think the activity has value. And
sure.
I think that the extreme of saying the unexamined life is not worth living, I think is maybe a bit extreme, but I've found that in my life, I've been able to kind of take the process itself that comes from examination and discourse and so forth and apply it to all kinds of topics. The problem is that at the end, what I'm going for is not absolute truth, but instead some kind of like what I would call pragmatic state where you can impel action or move forward, right? What I mean by that is it doesn't really matter whether ultimately you're right or wrong about the thing you're discussing, as long as you get to a point where you can make an acceptable decision about what correct action to do or what action to move forward with.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where it all kind of separates. See, for me.
For me, I said this to someone recently, I really only want to do things that are useless now, which seems like an odd thing to say. Whereas when I was in grad school, when we were together at the University of Texas studying this stuff, I was tormented by the idea that this was all bullshit, and it was totally impractical, and it was completely pointless. I knew I was attracted to it, but I knew also that there was no prestige to be gained from it, no money, and that in some sense it was pointless, that you weren't going to answer any of these questions. And, of course, Socrates himself doesn't seem to think that in this lifetime you're going to answer any of these questions. You're just going to go about confirming your own ignorance. On the other hand, you know, we could talk about all sorts of pragmatic consequences, and that's the kinds of thing that these days they try to use to lure undergraduates into liberal arts programs.
Well, you'll be able to write clearly.
Not simply to go into business, a business program. Yeah. You'll gain analytical skills.
Law schools love you.
Yeah.
If you do this.
Yeah, logical, critical thinking skills and writing and all that. But I think, so one component, you know, we could talk about the pure pleasure of, let's say, the contemplative life. Although I don't think that would be enough, Seth. Your idea of the pragmatic and the practical is actually quite relevant, or it's more relevant to Socrates' thinking because he's thinking about what it means to lead a good life. Although, again, there's that tension between, you know, whether it leads you to make practical decisions or whether just being contemplative. The activity of thinking about what the good life is the good life in a sort of weird, paradoxical way. But I think one other thing we might mention is sort of the, if anything, the more modern version of attempt at the examine life, which is something that a lot of people do, which is going to therapy, where the idea is that there's going to be some sort of, I guess it's reframed in terms of the idea of health, which is our sort of modern idea of what it means to be virtuous.
I think that's really interesting, Wes. I didn't realize you were sort of tortured and so challenged.
Glad it wasn't obvious.
Well, you know.
Did you think this was useful while you were doing it?
Actually, Seth? I mean, I always wanted to do this. I mean, I never had any desires to do anything else. Although when I was an undergraduate, I'll admit I had transferred from one school to another, and philosophy had the fewest number of required hours in order for me to get my degree. So for me to graduate in 4 years, it was like one of the few majors I could have picked. But I also at the time thought I was kind of an arrogant, obnoxious prick, and it seemed like it was well suited for that kind of temperament, which turned out to be true. But you know what? I always thought that the activity of studying philosophy and the process was valuable. And I guess to some sense, I held the bias. I mean, I was very much sympathetic to the Socratic character back in the day, because I always had this idea that, you know, philosophy kind of started off as everything, and they kept carving off small pieces of it and turned them into sciences, right? So you start here, you see natural sciences, and then, you know, the other kinds of sciences and psychiatry and linguistics in the 19th and 20th century. And I felt like philosophy was somehow the original well that still asked the really critical fundamental questions. But the problem was that, you know, it seemed to me you kept getting to points where there was no way to resolve the decision about was it A or was it B. If you get down to a certain level when you're talking about, you know, all you can do is refer to the argument and the assumptions, and to some extent some people will agree with one, some people will agree with another, and you get stuck at an impasse. And that what I've found is that the judicious application of that process and reasoning to what you might call more practical matters has made me extremely effective in my life and in my professional role. And it's the reason that I tell everybody to not go to business school and to go to a liberal arts education.
Yeah,
it's precisely because you learn how to discriminate arguments and facts from opinions and beliefs and poor inference and all that. And as long as you're able to apply that to a wide variety of things, you'll be very successful. But to get back to Wes's point about sort of therapy being the current version of the examined life, the difference is that two things. One is it's true in the sense that it's discourse. And this has been kind of a recent revelation for me about the importance of discourse and dialogue in terms of creating identity and relationships between people and so forth. But the thing about therapy is that it's very centered on the individual. You don't go into therapy to talk about the nature of truth or objects or the characteristics of objects and what you can know and can't know and so on. So I still think there's that gap. There isn't a public forum or a kind of standardized one-on-one kind of forum to have the examined life in this day and age.
So how can we get people to pay us $100 an hour to come in and engage in the examined life? That is qualified philosophical therapists.
Working on that as you speak. Actually, there are. Did you know that there is an association? And all you need is a master's degree in philosophy.
Yeah.
Serious.
Yeah, I remember exploring that a little bit way back when.
And you can get
me
rid
too.
Of
me too. And then I felt engrams. Dirty and ashamed of myself.
And you can get rid of your engrams and become a clear if you do this. That is a Dianetics reference for those.
You know, I had a dream about Dianetics last night. But anyway.
One way that people can do it is, you know, there are a lot of very educated and intelligent and interesting people who are, say, teaching at community colleges nearby, right? I mean, there's the opportunity is there. The question is, how do you motivate people to find a forum to do this activity, right?
Right. I wanted to address both of those threads, Seth. I agree that the idea that it's helped me professionally, I've definitely felt that. But also, not just in the sense of being able to be a clear thinker, let's say. But also there's a certain, you're bombarded with a tremendous amount of bullshit these days with very, there's the sort of management speak and all those sorts of things. And people take very seriously a lot of stupid ideas and the idea that they're, you know, they'll read marketing books and the Tao of marketing and this and that. And I feel like I at least have been able to see through some of that in a way that not everyone does. Not that you know.
Right, exactly. I think it is likely that most philosophy people are happily immune to that kind of stuff, but that doesn't mean it's in any way necessary. I feel like most of the bullshit that comes our way, for instance, politically, like, come on, if you've got half a brain and you read a little bit, like, you can figure out what's going on. Not in depth in terms of what should we do to fix the economy right now and crap like that, but in terms of just, you know, when you're blatantly being told a pack of lies.
Right. And that, you know, and that brings up the, well, first I'm gonna, and the other thing is the whole therapy issue. I think it is very different. The, you know, the sort of classes I've taken at this psychoanalytic institute, some of them are quote unquote process oriented, which means students, it's like group therapy to some extent, and it's also like a class. And it becomes a big excuse for people not doing readings and not ever discussing readings. And, you know, oddly, you know, some of the readings are very, very abstract. But people focus, you want to focus on, let's say, the emotional, which is what you're trying to get to in the analytic situation or when you're in therapy. So it's a different kind of, I didn't want to conflate those two. It's a different idea of the kind of truth that you're getting to, because it's more about the emotional experience and the relationship with the analyst than it is about. But they're related in the sense, again, of this idea of what it means to be virtuous and what it means to live a good life. And
you guys both gave your kind of origin story, so let me do the equivalent, which is I started in philosophy out of sort of a religious quest for knowledge, of the idea, very much like Plato has, that you can't do the right thing unless you know what the right thing is, and you can't know what the right thing is until you have a conception of what the right thing means, right? You have to do meta-ethics before you could do ethics, and before you do that, you have to know metaphysics, right? So that you have to know whether there's a God or not who's going to be telling you to do stuff, or if there is no God that is not telling you to do stuff, then is there any sense in which you should do anything or not? I really, you know, had this very, like, we have to answer the basic metaphysical questions about the structure of the universe and stuff before we can even figure out, you know, what job to pick. And so I was very firmly convinced, for instance, that every adult that I had any contact with was fundamentally clueless, because surely they had not discovered these profound things and so chosen their shitty job at, you know, being a cafeteria lunch lady or whatever, or being a business person with the requisite reflection. And so I pursued this, and I did enough philosophy. Now, I know that certainly in religious matters and other matters, you get to a point where you can't convince other people. I think that's what Seth was saying in terms of you can't establish things past a certain point in a lot of these purely philosophical as opposed to scientific disciplines. But I got to a point where I could convince myself, you know, so I figured out how likely I thought the various things were. And so by the middle of college or so, I'd kind of done my spiritual journey far enough, reached my end point. It's refined a little bit over the years, but, you know, I had gotten most of what I wanted to get out of that for that. Well, at that point, doing philosophy and reading more about these things and arguing these things was kind of fun. And I like learning about science without having to learn too many of the details of science, right? Actually having to learn anatomy at the level of a physician would be painful and awful to me.
Or but, having to touch people.
Well, that's true. But, you know, learning to the extent that I was in my bio psychology class, where you learn, you know, roughly what the areas of the brain are and what they're supposed to do, but I don't have to do any experiments on this. You know, so it was a nice way in a lot of different sciences to be a dilettante. Eventually, through grad school, you know, I came to appreciate the scholarship, the fetishizing of these dead people, of becoming a fan of Kant in the same way you'd become a fan of a band or an author or something, which is where it gets really weird to those not in the profession. But then leaving the profession, I have some good perspective on how weird it was, but I also see that it's probably a much more pleasant way to spend your time than most things other people have to do with their day.
Exactly.
And of course, there are all these byproducts that you were talking about of being able to write and communicate clearly and use all these things for other jobs that I've been able to do since then. But I don't know that that's translated into, you know, making more mature decisions about my life, or, you know, I certainly find, as I was kind of alluding to before, like philosophical discussions, you know, not that useful in resolving most of the everyday arguments, say, in figuring out what to do from day to day with my family.
Right.
You know, in fact, it's more being too into this seems like you're being selfish, like you're doing what Socrates was doing, which I got to say, if the dude is, again, choosing death over giving a damn that his two children are going to grow up without a dad or whatever, and clearly it's been the case that he's been neglecting them on a daily basis forever, as great men think they have the right to do for their entire lives, just seems entirely confused.
Yeah, you could ask whether the withdrawal is really pathological, because in one sense, it's like, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with the real world. You know, like you said,
science and politics.
Mark, the natural sciences. It reminds me of a professor who once said of philosophy, you know, how did I end up in philosophy? Well, I tried other things. You know, I tried the scientists, but I had to go into a laboratory and titrate and pour stuff in the beakers and tried other things. He was a boxer. And he said, finally, I got to philosophy and all I needed was a pen and paper. And then he said, and that's when I knew. So he called it a form of laziness, which I thought was an interesting description.
Interestingly, one of the reasons I feel like I was, one of the excuses at least I was making to myself at the time when I was not working on my dissertation when I was supposed to be, was that, you know, if only it were 20 years from now and everything was on the internet, because I could not stand like just hanging out at the philosophy library so much. And with that bit of profundity, we come to the end of part one, but you can go to unexaminedlife.com or iTunes to get hold of The Unexamined Life, episode one, part two. Please